Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
I have hit the record button, Jules.
Okay, cool.
Segue
cool.
Into all this thing, because this is the UPP.
UPP. Or technically, it's a gathering of the gown gang.
Everyone's the gown gang.
Got your gowns on.
Welcome along. Your gown's very big, Mr. Jules Gill. Have you killed something in between the weeks since last
Listen,
Friday?
As a full-on vegan, I can say that no animals have been harmed in this, but it's like a bear's pubes, mate. It's thick and coverage. It's good times. Good times.
I mean, we're living in what I think is the coldest day of in UK history or some craziness.
It can get in the bin, mate. It's awful.
Yeah.
You try working. You've got a nice setup there. You've got nice walls. So it looks like you've got a little like throw pillow in front of you or like a cushion.
You don't want to know what this is. This is a weird, like there's a microphone in here and that's how I'm able
to
record.
Your recording?
I can kind of rotate it, but it's kind of like, there's a little microphone. It's going to break everything. So,
well, see, I thought that was like comfy. You're that microphone, mate. You're nice and comfy. Imagine trying to work in a garage that doesn't have a heater in here. I've got a portable fan heater.
I haven't got a heater in here either. I've got this really ridiculously sized room that doesn't heat up. I've got the slippers on.
I've got a big house.
Look at me. I've got a giant airy room, which for the most part I do enjoy. But welcome to the UBP. I'm Scott Taylor, joined by Jules Gill. And each week, obviously, we ask everybody whatever's on their mind. What do you want us to talk about? Game stuff, recipe stuff, food stuff. And so we're going to start with a game-based question, then we'll get into some different things.
I was about to say, I'm glad to say that we're getting into the game-based stuff because we have been getting so much food stuff recently that it's just a case of like, are we now like a food podcast?
Well, you're the one who put out the Marmite and sour cream.
No, I didn't put it out there. I gifted it to the world, mate. Well, I gave them what they needed. It's the dark night of sandwiches.
That's like giving someone like a present that you know is a joke present, but the person just has to live with it now. So I've got to try and ascribe value to this thing. So first question from Laughing Sunbro, a regular from the Take Trough. Thank you very
Legend.
Much yet again. Do you think game companies are holding back games like God of War 2 until such a time as the PS5 is more readily available? Does that make business sense?
I think that makes perfect sense. You would want to have your game launch on the biggest install base possible for a console. So actually sometimes holding off and teasing that it's coming is a great way to incentivize people to A, buy the console and to then get hyped for your release. I can't think of a better game either to make me want to buy it into a PS5 other than the God of War. I think this is amazing.
Yeah, the thing with God of War, Sony are in such a strange place where like obviously they have a massive shortage. Sony themselves got out there and said that they don't think they're going to be able to manufacture whatever the specific component is that gets them back to regular production until closer to 2022. So that leaves them in a weird position.
It?
I know that leaves them in such a weird position of just saying like, well, we have all these exclusives. We have Returnal, Gran Turismo, Ratchet and Clank, God of War, all these things that are penned for 2021, but we also know that the vast majority of people can't get their hands on systems. So maybe it does just make sense to delay it, and you're ostensibly delaying the generation by like a year, because all these games that I just said are also on PS4, including Horizon Forbidden West.
Because so I mean, you're kind of like in a situation where like, you know, the classic sort of supply and demand curves, they don't apply here because of the fact that you don't have the supply in the first place to actually, like the demand was already sky high because it's a brand new console thing. And now telling people that there's scarcity of it, it's just kind of like, well, if I was a game developer right now and I was told, oh, do you want to release your game now or do you want to hold off for a bit? I would tell my team, like, we're going to hold off for a bit. We're going to make less money now because by the time that if we drop it now, we've got less people buying it. And then when the supply finally finally comes back around so that people can buy the consoles, they'll be expecting it to be discounted because it will have already been out for so long.
It's retroactively, it kind of explains why at the end of last year, just after the launch, they got out there and said, oh, like X number of PS5 games are also on PS4, because maybe that's the only way they can split the difference right now. It's like, well, we're still going to get so many games off shelves. We're not, because they haven't said anything about God of War 2, which is why it keeps leading to the idea that it's either cross-gen or it's being delayed or whatever. It was the only game that didn't get a release date in the last sort of PlayStation trailer thing. And I'm like, yeah, maybe their way of splitting the difference is, look, we know you guys already have PS4s, so we're going to give you next-gen games, quote-unquote, but as best we can. I mean, Ratchet & Clank is one of the only ones that's on PS5 only.
I genuinely think that we need to start really looking to move away from it. Like, I know that it hasn't been the smoothest console transition between the two, but they need to start defining points now. Something that actively puts me off after the whole Cyberpunk debacle is literally just like, if God of War comes out and says, oh, it will be on the PS4 and the PS5, my brain is only going to see that there has been a glass ceiling that's been put on that game for the limitations of the PlayStation 4. Like, the only way you would sell me on top of it is if you went, okay, cool, here's the core experience, but the PS5 one's going to have these three new locations, all of these new bosses, and like basically come with an expansion pack built in. That's the way you could separate it. But if you just told me they're going to be the same games, I'd be like, well, mechanically, we're not going to be able to advance beyond the first one.
That's the thing. We're in a weird space at the minute where a lot of like next, because like there's, like, you look at Demon's Souls and Godfall are the only two games right now that have been made for the PS5. Like everything else is like, you know, getting a next gen patch. And it's not that God of War 2018 looks incredible in 60 FPS at 4K. Like, that looks great. But it's also not built from the ground up for the next generation, whereas Demon's Souls, you can tell, has been. So for me, I want those new experiences just on a sheer artistic, creative level. I want to see what devs are coming up with, you know, aiming for that tech and only that tech.
I mean, on a sort of lower point than that, you've paid for the experience. You've paid on the, sold on the idea that you were going to be able to play these brand new games and have all of these experiences. Like at the moment, this like shortfall of a library that just has, is pretty bare bones. It's quite disarming to players coming in. They're just like, why would I ever want to invest in this console right now?
And it's like, it's not, like I said, it's not that those older patches don't, not necessarily revolutionize, but make those games feel good and fresh. Like Days Gone, Ghost of Tsushima.
But you've played it before.
We played them, and it's like 4K 60 can only do so much. And so I think it's going to be a bit of a stilted start to the generation, but obviously you can, you know, we all know why, we've all been through this. But yeah, I kind of wonder if Sony are kind of splitting the difference by going like, we're still going to give you these new titles, but just not as upscaled as they could be. And then it's kind of on them to justify a separate PS5 release if they decide to charge for it. Next question from Anthony Attic, who says, tricks for getting comfortable on camera. Literally, ironically, exposure. I would it's just literally, it took this long. I mean, we've both been on camera. I think you longer than me. I started in 2015, but most of those videos have been deleted at this point.
Yeah, we kind of worked together quite a lot at the beginning of my run. I remember that. And I remember when I came in, I was so nervous. I was a bag of jittery nerves. And so is everyone. Like, I can't stress this enough. Even if you look around the most sort of like confident people on camera, at one point in time, they weren't. And the only reason that they got over that is by basically looking at themselves going, Jesus, right, there's the bottom line. I can only go up from here. Like when I started, I stumbled over my words. Like I got so confused with what I wanted to say. I didn't have any sense of purpose on camera. So I basically was just there like a bag of nerves, just there like, okay, here we go. At the end.
Everybody sort of thinks that because there is like a version of you that's on camera, and obviously the version of you that's just like normal. Mm-hmm. And it's weird because for me, it's like when you start out, you're like, oh man, I need to be this perfect version of me. I need to say everything perfectly.
Yeah.
I need to enunciate everything. I need to make sure I nail every point immediately and I can't mess up. And oh my God, I got that wrong. That's an outtake. We need to start again. Whereas for me, one of the biggest turning points was just steering into that stuff. Like if something goes wrong or you mess something up or you need to clarify, it's fine. You just keep the take rolling. You stay with it and you just keep going. Obviously that applies to different contexts, whether it's a live show or you're trying to get through something or whatever. But for me, it was steering into the version of me that is a little bit stumbly and a little bit, I'll just make it up as I go along. And that's okay. It doesn't need to be perfect. It just needs to be you.
Yeah, because it's authenticity. That's what people actually come to see. If they come and like, there's nothing that turns me off more than watching those really, really prescribed adverts that you get for like people who, a good example is, and I'm not harshing on them specifically, there was a I won't actually say the name of the thing just in case it gets me into trouble, but there was a specific game advert that came out that was presenting it as if it was like real life, but it was all just so forced. Every single like thing was just like, this is how you play the game. Wow, I love this. It's like, like that. Yeah. That sort of manufactured thing is not personable. That's not at all like what I would want to see. I want to see people going, okay, well, I don't know how to play this. Like, show me how to do this. Like, what's going on, sort of thing.
Yeah, and I would also say, I mean, to this day, I still get like a performance anxiety before I hit record. I think I'm always aware that, not necessarily for this, because it's much easier talking to someone, but if you're doing like a solo thing, like to camera, and especially at home, we don't have the teleprompter or anything. So it is just improvising entire like spiels.
Yeah, that's a thing that I reckon that a lot of people don't realize this, is that when we were in the office, a lot of the stuff that we did, like we call this like face to cam, is like we had like a teleprompter, and that helps so much. You have no idea.
Only
like,
recently, we will say a lot of it was still made up in the last
Yeah, like a lot of it, but it was like we probably had like a year and a half or 2 years without it, then a year with it, and now all this time without it. And I would say that, because I find that I'm funnier when I script myself, when I write down my jokes, I get my thoughts out onto paper, I found it easier to bounce off the teleprompter because I would see the line I needed to hit. I would just then go full on energy with the enunciation. But being away from it actually teaches you to think on your feet a lot more. So like if you're asked a question you don't know the answer to, if you're put into a situation where you stumble, how do you react to that? And I think that the best advice that I can give is, if you hit a stumbling block, don't just go, right, scrap it. We're going to start from the first paragraph again. If you can turn that around and get back out of it again, you'll feel so much better for yourself for doing it. Like Simon Miller does it all the time. Like he's one of the most confident people that we know. And yet if he makes a mistake, he'll just be like, oh, blah, blah, I don't know what I said. That's not what I meant to say. What I meant to say is that he'll just carry on.
That's what I mean. It's authentic. It's, yeah.
Yeah. And it becomes this sort of like a tribute that people gravitate towards because they're like, oh, you make mistakes, but you're still confident in yourself to carry on going. And I think that's something that that is essential to learn.
Yeah, 100%. It's like I said, it was just, I still get some of the performance anxiety stuff before I hit record for a big important thing. Like when I reviewed the Medium the other week, I have so many things I need to say. It depends what you're going to be covering, but I sort of like note down the points I want to hit and then improvise getting from A to B to C or whatever. And then like, obviously you're aware of the editing on the other side of it. It changes if it's a live stream, but yeah, overall I would boil it all down to just keep doing it. It's like when you first learn to drive and you're a little bit hazardous or a little bit apprehensive on the road, just do more of it and improvise through stuff.
Never be afraid as well either to use footage to mask your cuts and stuff like that. Like if there's one thing that makes a presenter, in my opinion, look a bit weaker, is when you get hard cuts after sentences where it's still like, say it was like the footage of Scott and I, and it just suddenly cut to, and this is what we're doing now. Like you can tell that there was a mistake or there's something there. If you cut to footage and then just go to a voiceover bit, then it's a really easy way to keep that flow going and make sure that the audience just think it's one continuous take.
I will also like just throw in that I think YouTube editing has become its own style, like recognizable style, like that. Even those harsh cuts sometimes are totally fine if that's all you have to play with and you don't have time to redo something.
It's a great way of injecting energy into a scene. But the problem is that sometimes if you do it after every single sentence, or sometimes with some of these YouTubers, like midway through sentences, you're like, oh, you've not had a coherent thought there. Right. So maybe just take a second and get your thoughts out like in some other way.
It depends what resources you've got. But I think, we've been doing this for 5, 6, 7 years now. So time's a flat circle, but you can. Next question from Tony Peace, which is a brilliant name, Mr. Tony Peace. What are each of your favorite and most hated video game controllers? This is hard. A hated video game controller.
I feel like if I really wanted to annoy people, I'd say it was the N64. I feel like that's just like... I am actually from that camp, which sees both the positives and negatives of that controller. One that I hate hands down is the Duke, the original Xbox controller. I'm sorry, mate. I'm sorry, dude.
I just bought one. What?
I know you did.
Hadjibah. The thing is, you are completely right. It is one of the most like wrong wrong controllers ever made. Ergonomically insane. But I love that. I think it's the nostalgia of it kind of does it for me. But when I first held it when I was younger, it was huge. It was something that only my friend's brother could hold. And I think that just made getting to grips with it, literally trying to get to grips with it, trying to play Halo, that little bit more special, but it is a bit mental.
So it's a cumbersome thing, isn't it? But what's the best controller?
I think I was going to say for the Duke, they did re-release it. You can get one from Hyperkin, and the where the logo used to be, that plays a video version of the Xbox boot up animation.
Amazing.
Which is a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the worst, I don't know, my mind also went to the N64, even though I don't hate it. It just doesn't have a real way to hold it. It's either the middle and the side, or kind of both sides. The best controller, though, I think would actually be the DualSense, the new one, the PS5 one.
Ooh, okay.
Maybe the DualShock 4, anything that has a bit of weight to it. I like a bit of heft to get my
hands. I'm a big fan of the Xbox 360 or the Xbox One controller, because I felt that the Xbox One controller just had those lovely tactile triggers. They had that, it just felt weighty and chunky. I found ergonomically, I really, really liked it.
Yeah.
However, maybe we should return to the terrible controllers and extend it to like special edition controllers, because there are some absolute stinkers in there.
Oh, I remember the chainsaw controller for
Resident Evil. I was just about to say that. Like, people who were like, oh, I really like this, is brilliant. It's like, have you played it? I played it once. My friend bought the special edition and I was like, this is, it looks amazing, but it's so awful.
I never owned it, but I saw the pictures of that Dragon Quest slime one where it's just a big rat, which looks great. Maybe that's lovely. I don't know.
I won't have a bad word said about the slime made from there. Slime Jesus, praise him
slime
hard.
Jesus, but popping in.
But the thing is, I have to admit, it was pretty bad as well, because it doesn't look good at all. It looks like, because you have to hold it upside down.
It's like a big orb, yeah.
Yeah, but I imagine that's the last thing that you'd want to try and hold for a long amount of time. It's like, oh, are you gripping it? It's like, no, I'm just kind of resting it on my palms.
Well, massaging it? I think, I don't know, I like the idea. I love gaming hardware. Like, I love a new console, I love a new controller, and I like the gimmicky side of that. But I think, yeah, like you said, any extended amount of time, it's just going to make it feel terrible over time. Yeah. I can't think, there's not been any controllers that I've actively hated, but I think some are just more cumbersome.
I'm going on the Googles as per usuals.
Okay.
Just 2 seconds while I look up terrible, terrible video game controllers.
There is one, is it the Falcon? There's that discontinued system that looked like a calculator that was just sort of blown up, had a ton of rows of buttons on it.
Oh my God, I think I've just seen the one that you're talking about.
It's like, it looks like one of those science calculators you use in school and never with just sort of, it's fatter, it's got grips on. It was a whole thing. The gaming industry trying to explore ergonomics without social media and data back in the day.
Okay. So apparently some of the worst ones, according to the internet, are the Amiga CD32, which looks like somebody tried to design a boomerang and gave up halfway. So that's great.
Oh my God. The original PS3 controller. That was that weird silver banana.
That sucked.
I liked that when I was a kid, but I was a dumb kid. So I was just like, oh, that looks cool. It's futuristic.
Oh my God, the Philips CDI controller. This is appalling. It's literally like a DVD remote. That's just awful.
They look like video controllers, like sort of with a VHS controller.
Would it be harsh to just rail on the power glove? Because it just didn't work?
It never worked, yeah.
Yeah.
You can nominate one more as your worst controller.
Okay, one more. I think I know which one it's going to be. Just the entire Virtua Boy. it gave you a headache. And just
I've never played one of them.
Oh, I played it once. It was at a retro gaming convention thing. Mm-hmm. And I was there like, oh, sick. I'm finally going to be able to play the Wario Land that's exclusive to this. And I was like, I heard so many good things about it. I put it on and I was there like, oh, okay, yeah, this is quite interesting. I can feel like a sense of depth. Mm-hmm. And then I became aware of the sheer weight of it. I was just like, it needs like a counter brick on the other side to get your head back up. And then after about 5 minutes, I took it off. And I swear, as soon as I took it off, an actual real light and color of the spectrum entered my eyeball. Immediate headache. I was just like, oh, my
it's such
gosh.
A. I mean, I love the ambition of 80s Nintendo, but it's just like this all red. It looks like you're seeing blood. Like it's just sort of it's like your brain's malfunctioning.
You're having like the aneurysm is seeping into your eyeballs.
And so I think this is a game feature, but I don't know. Next question from Ethan: should I play through all the Resident Evil games for 8, or should I just play through 7? That's a hell of a gamble. A choice.
That is you know what? There's merits and cons to both. Yeah. Because if you play through every single one, you'll get an appreciation for where the series started from, developed to, declined to, and then rose up from. But because it is directly tied to Ethan's story, it would make sense for you to just roll straight off the back of Resident Evil 7 into 8. Yeah.
My thing would be, because I can't on good conscience, man, ask anybody to play Resident Evil 6, as much as I think that's a guilty pleasure. It's only a guilty pleasure now going back to it after they've recovered the series. My shout would be at least try Resident Evil 1 Remake so you get a feel for the tank controls and you see where it started, with albeit better graphics and everything. Then jump to the Resident Evil 2 Remake because it's such an overhaul and you've got the modernized controls. And then I would actually skip the Resident Evil 3 Remake because it really didn't do anything for me.
I play the original. So if we create a timeline, I'm totally with you. Where you start start with the Resident Evil, the remake that was for the GameCube one.
Yeah, which then became on PS4. And Yeah.
Then we'll go to the Resident Evil 2 remake, like you said. Skip the Resident Evil 3 remake and play the original, because that is phenomenal. Yep. Resident Evil 4, for sure.
Yep. Then I think you're okay. I think I would, after you do 4 with Leon, I would jump to Resident Evil 7. Because I think, as much as I enjoy 5 and 6 as gameplay mechanics and everything, I don't think they're essential at all. If you're going to get a feel for where the series went, you get that from 4 anyway. And then you can kind of just jump to 7, which is the reboot. I mean, 5 and 6 just reinforce the gunplay, we're chasing Gears of War stuff.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think if there are any of the spin-off ones that are worth playing as well. Oh, Code Veronica.
That's an old school tank one. I guess you could do that after you've done one remake, because I don't know where that is in the tank. I mean, I would recommend Revelations.
Is it essential?
I don't think
Revelations
so.
Is great, mate. Revelations. Yeah. I love Revelations. I'm playing through it on the 3DS again, because I don't know if I told you, I dug out my 3DS and I was just like, oh, it's in there. Play this for a bit. And I was like, that's a really brilliant game.
We just dug out, me and my wife dug out our 3DSs last night as well. That's really weird. It was like, we need lockdown stuff, so we dug out old consoles.
I found some absolutely amazing games in my collection, by the way.
Star Fox. I haven't played Star Fox in so long.
Oh, such a good game, especially for the 3DS. I got some of the Professor Layton games, so I was going to play through them. Sure. But I also have, what's it called? Monster Hunter. Monster Hunter 3. And I have only played Monster Hunter 3 on the 3DS. I never played it on when it came to the... So I'm like, oh yeah, dude. I haven't even got I haven't got the little nubby one either.
I was going to say...
So I've got the terrible control. So I'm just like, oh, this sucks.
You target for a little bit and it doesn't lock. It just keeps going. It just rotate the camera every 10 seconds.
I'm having fun, but it is abysmal at the same time.
But I think if we were going to... Because another thing is that Resident Evil 8 is out in May. So you've got that... You're crunching these games to get through quite a lot of them in a couple of months. RE1 remake, jump to 2, then RE3 original, then RE4, and then jump to 7, I would say.
Okay, I think if we're being brutal and we're trying to cut it down so that you can do it,
can we cut any more?
Like, if we're going for just the essentials,
I would cut RE3, man. Like, I love Nemesis, but I think if you want to get the vibe of Resident Evil, that's RE1 remake, that's RE2 remake, and then 4, because that was such a change. Even though you're going to get a bit of that from 2, but at least, like, story-wise, 4 is brilliant. The setting of it's great.
So 4 games, you're saying?
Yeah.
So do Resi 1 remake, Resi 2 remake, 4 and 7, and then in.
Yep. And then 4 as well goes into 8, because the merchant comes back and there's all the... They're taking a bunch from RE4, so you've kind of got a bit of connective tissue there.
God, it feels so horrible to hack so much of a brilliant franchise out. Like, I feel like it's sacrilege to even suggest not playing some of these games.
I think it's funny, because I went back to RE6. I don't know why now. I just got this weird brain fart the other week and I was like, I kind of want to play a bit of Resident Evil 6. So I got that.
You're mad.
I just sort of did it. I think it was on sale for like a fiver, and I was like, I'm going to see what... Because I started RE6 back in the day, did what everybody did and went, what the hell is this? But going back to it after RE7, it's the same with DMC5. Once Capcom got the franchise back on track, like, I quite like DMC from 2013 now, because I know that it didn't kill the franchise. And so now that they've saved Resident Evil, going back to 6 is kind of like this weird guilty pleasure action-focused thing that I know didn't kill stuff, because 7's still okay. So yeah, I think you can appreciate them retrospectively, like after the fact. Like, you play the good ones and then you play the weird deviations that they tried, and it's like, I see what you guys were going for, but it didn't work, but I'm glad you came back, as opposed to, oh my God, what the hell are they doing?
I mean, I still maintain that the best thing that Resident Evil 6 did was kill that formula for them. Like, and the worst thing is, I did some research on the other day, that it's I think it is the highest selling Resident Evil game. And that upsets me.
Well, it's same with Splinter Cell. The more they steered into the action stuff, the more the fans went, what are you guys doing? But the more it worked in mainstream audiences. Like Conviction, I mean, I love Blacklist, but Conviction sold really well. Like, it's looking into Splinter Cell sales figures, Pandora Tomorrow and Chaos Theory dropped off and then came back with Double Agent. It's a whole thing. But
started, everyone.
Splinter Hell is the name of my documentary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
Next question from Hot Beverage Tea and Nerding Face. I think that's my copy-paste bringing emoji descriptions in, but whatever. What is the wankiest cocktail you found? Sounded fancy, but tasted like dirt. £1 million for some fruit juice and one shot of alcohol?
Oh, the wankiest cocktail that I've ever had. I've had a fair few cocktails, which I've just been like, oh, they sound great. And then I've just been like, oh, I'm bad on like this,
for them
brother.
To shake it all together. My thing, it reminded me of a one from the before times. I don't even know if this place is even still open in Newcastle. I think it was called Bijou, but they did a Cookie Monster cocktail. It was called that, where they took an Oreo with a bunch of like whipped cream and all these different bits of chocolate and stuff. And it was really lush. But they made the Cookie Monster's face with like chocolate drops for the eyes. The Oreo on its side was the mouth. And then there was like a blue foam thing on top, which is kind of the opposite of what the dude's saying, because I thought that was brilliant. I had like five of them in a row. But yeah, still very wanky though, the Cookie Monster.
I had a minty mudslide a while back. It was probably like maybe we're talking 10 years ago. This, and it was like a mint chocolate and vodka combination, and it tasted amazing. Okay. My stupid ass decided that would be my next drink for the next hour and a half. So I decided to have 3 or 4 more of them.
Brilliant.
And is it any surprise that I then vomited out like black sludge into a gutter, like about like 5 minutes after I left the pub? And all my friends were like, oh, why did you switch from like beer to this really bizarre dessert? And I'm like, I don't know.
Everyone does that thing where they find the cocktail, it's like, this could be me. This could be part of me. This is my identity now. This is my like extension of me. Like, always, you know, like, I come in and I get this cocktail and no one else gets it. And that's me. No, they're just, it depends which one it is, but I think overindulging is always bad.
Speaking of cocktails that are definitely us, one of the amazing fans that we have went and designed a cocktail for us. Did you see on Twitter?
No.
Yeah, on Twitter, they went and designed it. I'll have to find it, so you might have to vamp a little bit while I do this. But
I can describe various things around around cocktail culture, the idea that just, I don't know, like we mentioned the other week about the dressing gowns that we have, the White Russians being something that you should get like traditionally for each week's episode. I don't know whether we should branch
into dug up, by the way, some really horrible cocktails for people at home to try.
Brilliant.
Because I typed in worst cocktails ever and I've got some absolute stinkers. One of them, I'll just read you out now, is called the Smoker's Cough. Do you want to know what that is?
Yes, sure.
It makes me feel a bit queasy just saying it. Jägermeister and mayonnaise mixed together in a shot glass.
You're supposed to avoid dead air, but I don't know how to. I'm curious.
No, you're not.
When we're allowed outside again, if that was suggested in some sort of, you know, external establishment, I think we'd try it.
I would never try Jägermeister and mayonnaise.
Well, but you're advocating for Marmite and sweet chili sauce or whatever.
No, do not put the two on the same level, Scott. They are totally, totally different.
They are scientifically the exact same amount of madness.
I'll tell you what, you keep going with this show and I will find this because I'm scrolling okay. back. I'm now scrolling through a lot of mentions now to try and okay. find this.
So, next question from Andy Taylor. A few cinemas are looking to gaming as a new source of income, gaming in small groups or solo, and maybe once this is all blown over, we can have cinema gaming with more people. What game would you play in the cinema? And then he says, also, Parappa the Rapper VR should be a thing. Not necessarily in a cinema, otherwise it'd be one person in the foyer.
Parappa the Rapper VR. I can't think of anything more weird than that. Like,
it's all in the mind, mate. It's all in the eyes.
No, why does it need to be VR? That's, okay, right. Maybe it's because I'm a bit. Maybe it's because I'm a bit salty on the fact that very recently I've had to like dive into the Parappa the Rapper franchise.
Okay.
Just because I was doing a bit of like a deep dive into like bad remasters, and I hate to say it, everyone, but the PS4 remaster that came out for Parappa the Rapper was awful.
What are you doing? What's he doing?
No. I know that it sounds like I'm shooting myself in the face, but you go and play that on a HD TV.
Right.
The silly developers decided to take everything. Yeah, they took everything across, but they didn't count for the fact that the new technology would have latency issues. So the only way that you can say that you're good at the Parappa the Rapper remaster is to be bad rhythmically. That's not okay for a rhythm game.
I guess
game.
You could be in time. You just hit the button before the icon lines up. So you're still on the beat, you're on your own beat. Carly Rae style?
That's not okay.
But anyway, games in the cinema. I remember thinking this when I was younger, that like back when Gears of War came out, because I was just blown away by the spectacle of Gears. And I was like, this would be brilliant if we did it on a big enough screen. So my shout would be Gears of War split screen multiplayer, Halo original trilogy split screen multiplayer, Mortal Kombat fighting games, basically. The Odeon, the Odeon that's in the Metro Center used to do gaming nights, but I don't know if that was on the screen or it was more like a quiz-based thing. But if you got a cinema full of people and you threw on Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, and had a cash prize, I would take that in a heartbeat.
I would definitely be up for like fighting games in the cinema. Would just be fantastic. Or maybe a huge round of like Jackbox, like something like that, where it's like social game. Yeah, like everyone gets to vote and it's just like some people playing on stage with like people like doing
that. My God, Gang Beasts for one, having a Gang Beasts tournament with people getting eliminated, thrown out and stuff, maybe past the controller or something. Rocket League, because you can simulate the whole audience cheering and whatever when people score. Yep. Because I did go to a game tournament thing where they had a projector set up and there was an N64 playing Mario Kart. But everybody at that entire event just wanted to play Mario Kart. So there was just a swarm of people trying to play. So you never actually got hands on with it. But what was the thing you were going to say?
I have found the cocktail.
Good.
It doesn't have a name. Okay. But it does mix. So this is, we accepted, this is from Amanda at Randa Roy. We accepted your challenge. Here's my fiance's take on a drink with vinegar and eggs. One tablespoon apple cider vinegar, one lemon squeezed, 8 ounces of water, one liberal tablespoon of sugar, egg whites from one large egg, that's me, and 2 tablespoons of OJ. Perfect for a dressing gown morning.
I'll give it a shot. I mean, we did that weird apple sours and digestives and whatever it was punishment thing that me and Josh did when we lost a game once. But I'm curious. I mean, they've gone through quite a lot of effort there. That's very specific. I would also like to hear other people giving it a shot. I think I might try and give it a shot between this time and next Friday. Are you also going to attempt this cocktail?
Yes, but we're going to be calling this it's the UPP-UBD, Untitled Banter Podcast, Untitled Banter Drink.
That's very very professional of you. It's all the key terms in there. That'll get found on YouTube, lickety split.
Exactly.
Next question. This is a bit of a veganist question, but you've got to get out there. From Dan Pierce. Will we ever get a vegan cheese that doesn't taste like you've downed a keg of olive oil and made you wince so hard you're now staring through the back of your head? How do you find this?
Vegan cheese is one of those things where...
He's got you there, man.
You kind of think to yourself, like, why do you even bother half the time? Because it's not like somebody goes up to you and be like, oh, you're a vegan, are you? Oh, how do you find it not having milk and cheese? And you're just kind of like, yeah, cheese... I miss cheese quite a lot, actually. I used to eat cheese a lot. He's like, oh, don't worry. You've got your... let me count them. Your three vegan cheeses. Oh, do you like the fact that they're all just flavor? They're just flavor.
Has the whole idea of interrogating the vegans, has that become when people in the 90s and early 2000s would go up to someone with glasses on and go, oh, can I try them on? Oh, I can't see anything. Like, well, they're not made for you, are they, mate, to be honest?
They walk up with like a big mound of like EDAM and they just go like, oh, do you want some? Oh, you can't have
you
this.
You can't have that, can you?
What am I like? I forgot.
Trying to be cheeky.
At Christmas time, it is vegan paradise, my man, because of the fact that obviously January is around the corner and everyone tries to do veganuary. So that means that the companies get a lot of products in Christmas, which means they're like, I'll try this, get this already thing. And the cheese does step up a notch because I can't remember the VioLife. They've done like an extra mature cheddar and it actually tastes decent. It's really nice. Uh-huh. There's also like a jalapeno one that I had the other day. Mm-hmm. They tried to go a bit too far with some of them. Like they tried to replicate halloumi, the squeakiest of all cheeses. but it's not a good look. So I wouldn't
10 squeaky cheeses you can't replicate.
But there is one cheese above all that is actually pretty piff. And that is there's a garlic and herb goat's cheese spread. And it is, it's delicious.
I love it. And you put goat in
goat cheese.
Yes.
That's the only thing that really annoys me about vegan food, though, is that they always try and do like the punny names. It's like, it's not tuna or like, it's like frickin' instead of chicken. It's just kind of like,
That was what I wanted them to do more of. Cause I love like food. I love food. I love food science. I try vegan stuff as much as possible just to see how far along the technology is getting there, replicating me. And so I tried some vegan chorizo, which was honestly pretty terrible, but I like the idea of it. But that whole nomenclature thing, that whole idea of naming stuff, like, yeah, you've got carte blanche to create your own food stuffs. Like the sci-fi mind of mine is like, why don't you call it like alpha burgers or alpha discs or whatever? Like they don't need to be anything close to the animals we have.
If you came into school, right, with your Dairy Lunchables and you're just kind of like, oh, what you got there? It's like, oh, I've got some alpha discs. I would be like, I'll trade you the ham and cheese. That's
what I'm saying. You know, you could save lives. I just think that you bring it in, you call the noodles lightsabers. I don't know, do something.
But to go back to the point in hand, yes, there are some good cheeses. They're just a lot of bad cheeses as well, my friend. I feel your pain.
It's very fair. And a very quick question from Kieran McGregor. Discuss putting cheese in a pot noodle. Yeah? Why? You just put drooling face, exploding head.
You think you know a person and then I'm saying something like that. What the hell are you on about?
What have you done?
Sorry, I'm just trying to wrap my bean around this. You're saying that you want to take a pot noodle, which is at best okay.
It's not great.
And you want to chuck a... When you say you're putting cheese in it, what do you mean? Are you like grating cheese over the top of it? Are you putting a dollop of cottage cheese in? Or are you literally just whacking a bit off the edge of like a baby bowl and garnishing it on the... What do you mean? What are you on about?
It's got to be shredded. I mean, if you're putting a lump of cheese in, that's a level of insanity that I don't even... that's like saying SSX3 is better than Tricky. That's a level of insanity.
I almost swore quite loudly then.
I don't even know, I think he's grating it in. I think it mixes in with the noodles. It makes a nice little stodge and you sort of just take bites out of a giant lump of noodle cheese.
I think it's just because my brain's just gone insane and just went for the whole like, oh, you just taken a big wedge of cheese and
just
stuff. That is a no-go area. That is a no-fly zone for your tummy, my friends. But
it's very fair.
I can understand if you want to get a bit of like cheesy, nutty goodness in there, then yeah, I think that actually could work.
I mean, we'll have to try it. We've got our homework. We've got the cocktail. We've got the cocktail and the pot noodle side by side. But this time next week, we'll both have tried them. But next question,
my friend, though, just quickly, like what possessed you to do that in the first place? That's what I want to know. Is because sometimes you've got to be like, oh, where's the origin story from this? Like, oh, you know, I'm just going to chuck a bit of this and that. It's kind of like, what? You're just like, cheese good, pot noodle good, time to only eat one.
Like, it's kind of like the Family Guy thing with like the guy with the peanut butter and the guy with the chocolate.
Oh, the Reese's,
and they both
go
head to head into each other. And he's like, and the police officer like finds the combination. Like, yeah, maybe there's a way that those things came together. Next question, I think final question from Scott Elliott. There's a little known game in a bit of casting news recently. You might have already heard about it. He's referring to The Last of Us, which we got this question just after The Last of Us casting broke that Pedro Pascal is going to be Joel, Bella Ramsey is going to be Ellie. But also last night it broke that Jack Black's going to be Claptrap in the Borderlands movie.
So
we should just touch on all these things at once. What do you think of all these big lad actors coming in, actually playing, you know, decent actors? Oscar Isaac's going to be Solid Snake and everything. What's your thoughts on this next dimension of acting in video game movies.
Maybe this is it. Maybe this is our moment that actually we've all been waiting for so long, when it's been like we've suffered through the mediocre, the stodgy, the sludge-ridden trash that was the bad video game film era. So maybe we're in the Renaissance. Maybe we're about to be taken seriously. This is like when the first Batman film came out, Tim Burton's Batman, and reinvented the dark, gritty tone and set the superhero like genre going in that direction for quite a while. Maybe this is the point, the chrysalis period. Oh, it's going to be, I'm excited, but doesn't it actually make you a little bit more nervous? Because it's like the more big names that get added on, you're like, oh, wow, this is setting it up to be like really big, like not just, oh, big for the gaming circle, like big for whole, all of like mainstream industries. And you're just kind of like, oh, God, like, if it fails, if this is really bad, I'm like.
Well, there is that. I mean, it fascinates me in regards to like the Borderlands cast is insane. Like Jamie Lee Curtis is going to be Patricia Tanning or whatever. It's Cate Blanchett as Lilith, which I wouldn't like the age wise. I wouldn't have pegged her as Lilith, but I love Cate Blanchett as an actress. And then obviously you've got Kevin Hart and Jack Black so far. They haven't cast any villains or anything. We don't even know where it's set in the timeline. But like that as a cast, it's very Jumanji energy. It's very sort of like we've taken this, or we're trying to do this new energetic cast and add it to this sort of established
IP. But it all comes down to like who's writing it. Who's like
the dude that's writing Borderlands is Craig Mazin, the guy that did Chernobyl. So I'm just like, that's a hell of a swing. Like,
isn't it?
Also writing the Last of Us HBO show, along with Neil Druckmann's overseeing it and stuff. But yeah, Craig Mazin just in there, just doing everything. Just did Chernobyl, got enough credits, enough sort of trust, and then went, can I do Borderlands? Can I do Last of Us? He's the new Uwe Boll.
I mean, to be fair, if he can turn it around and do what he did for drama with comedy, then absolutely fantastic. Because this is the thing, to get the Borderlands tone right, they need to strike that delicate balance between actually being genuinely funny and like cringe, but also find it funny, because there's a ton of cringe throughout the Borderlands series, especially in like 2 and 3 when they dive deep into the, hey, look, we're taking the mick out of ourselves in gamer culture.
Borderlands was always cringe, so I kind of just went with that. But I get like a lot of people are like, oh my God, Borderlands 3 is like, it's too far. It's the wrong way to go.
Yeah, it's I had to do some more research on it because I was going back and I was trying to pick out all the flaws of like these amazing like threequels that everyone loved, but there's like some glaring issues. And I was just like, oh, okay, so I've got 4 pages of notes and I'm checks, watch. Ooh, only 5 hours of gameplay in. Interesting.
Yeah. Borderlands 3 is the one that I played the most. Like I was like, we did a chatty face on this ages ago where I just couldn't click with Borderlands 1 or 2. But I think
game-wise, it's fantastic. Like mechanic-wise, it's the best. Like hands down, I think it's the best. Like shooting and like they've got the loot grind down. They've got that systems down of like all the progression and stuff. It's fantastic. But when it comes to the narrative, my God, does it fall on its ass?
That's what's fascinating about making a movie out of that, because it's like, is it just going to be this like really surface level, let's just have fun with it, almost like Jumanji style thing, where Jumanji's basic plot structure is they're going to find something and that's it, and you just have fun with the chemistry between the actors. Like maybe that's all it's going to be. But then also Craig Mazin, like the potential thematic potential of it reducing someone like, you know, Handsome Jack last minute making this villain role. I don't know, there's just, it fascinates me in a way The Last of Us doesn't, because for me Last of Us is a complete package, whereas Borderlands has a whole narrative side that they haven't really done much other than Tales of the Borderlands.
Maybe this is going to be the sort of Sonic the Hedgehog movie where it's not actually super important that the first film does incredibly well, but that it sets up for the sequel, which everyone is excited for, because it's like if they can have that final shot of like Handsome Jack turning to camera like Thanos and being like, time to get this party started, and then pressing like the Hyperion button to like launch stuff down onto like Pandora, then I'd be like, I want to see that film. Like, hands down, you've got me hook, line, and sinker.
That's what makes me think that they'll do this first. I mean, they haven't announced anything in regards to the overall story or the villains yet, but if it's not Handsome Jack, then I think that's almost nailed on, because that's your perfect end of the movie sequel tease. And you hold back on announcing who's going to be Handsome Jack until they turn up in the film and maybe kill someone without going into spoilers. Like, Handsome Jack is responsible for some dead bods, so that could be a way.
If this is going to be the bet, right, okay, I'm trying to stay calm here now, because I'm talking about one of the biggest loves of my life. If they are going to cast all these people as accurately as they have done so far, there is going to be a point in time where they're going to have to introduce Tiny Tina.
Well, that's
if they get Ashley Birch and they just skip over the fact that, like, in the game she's meant to be very young, but if they just go like, no, she's like a 20, 30 year old woman or whatever, just like boom, if they get her straight in there with that, with her energetic over the top act, like, that'd be perfect.
That would be a hell of a thing. Actually, the question was also about The Last of Us. Very quickly,
mate, yeah.
What's your thoughts on Pedro Pascal and Bella Ramsey as Ellie? If you don't remember Bella Ramsey by name, she is Lyanna Mormont from Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm, she was the kid that killed the giant. Yeah, we did a whole news video on this, me and Josh, but I think it's a hell of a casting. I wouldn't have pegged Pedro Pascal off the top of my head. I was going more down the Nikolai Coster-Waldau, the Hugh Jackman route, but I think they're just, Pedro's got quite a quiet intensity to him I think they're going for.
But that's exactly what I imagine when I think of Joel. I don't think of this like over-the-top action hero like your Josh Brolins or whatever. I think of this like quiet, simmering, almost aggressive to the point where he's like because Joel's a dick, like all the way through. And I think that this guy can play that pretty well in the roles that I've seen him in before. He does this amazing ability of like capturing you into a scene in the palm of his hands, and then he'll twist it some way. He'll like do something that'll be like, oh, I don't actually like that character, or I don't like this. And I think that that's the perfect sort of keep your arm's length attitude that Joel should be giving off.
I've seen people recommending a movie from with Pedro Pascal. I think it's called Prospect. It's like a sci-fi thing where it's him and his daughter, or he finds this girl and they explore together on this planet. And like, I haven't seen that movie yet, but a lot of people are talking about how the chemistry between him and this younger girl, that's sort of like a daughter figure or father figure thing, is a little bit close to The Last of Us vibe. So I think that Prospect movie, I'm going to check that out and see what Pedro's like getting full dad energy. Because for me, he's the Mandalorian. He's the dude in Narcos. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen him in a dad role yet, so I'm kind of curious what that's like. But yes, thanks to everybody for sending in so many questions. I think next week we have so many things backed up in the overall take trough that I might put some sort of funny gif out, you know, do the thing. But also maybe we just do a catch-up week, because we've got a lot of stuff sitting in the trough and we can just dig that out.
Yep, that absolutely works as well. And if anyone's got any like suggestions for us that they want to see, or like outside of this, like extra bits and bobs that we can add on, then let us know.
I think that I feel sorry for everybody sending in so many questions, and we try and get through as many as we can, but there's still a ton. So I think that maybe next week we'll see how it goes. If stuff pops off in the industry, then we'll cover that, but because that's, you never know what's going to happen. Jack Black popping up, you just got to roll with it. But for now, this has been the UBP.
UBP.
I will catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.